Hi everyone, it's Nico here in Degrowth in Scotland podcast episode 5. I'm so excited to be here again on episode 5. You're going to hear me talking to Fiona and Thomas. This podcast brought to you by Enough, Scottish Degrowth Network, a network for anyone in Scotland interested or doing work in degrowth and decolonization. Please, let's get straight to the guest. Can you introduce yourself and tell us where you are and what you do?
Hello, Nico. I'm Fiona Morrison, and I live in Grimsey, which is a very small island in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland in the chain of islands called Uist. And I work with Thomas, who's on this call as well. And we work around supporting young people, particularly shining a light on the contribution young people are making to rural and island communities. And I'm very passionate about the rural and island economy and the assets that that provides for Scotland.
Thank you. Over to Thomas.
My name is Thomas Fisher. Along with Fiona, I am also a director of CODL, Community Development Lens. That's the organization that we work for and we founded. I live on South Uist, which is another island in the Outer Hebrides. And for this degrowth podcast, I'm really pleased that I can also say that I have a diverse background, having worked for many years in India on developmental issues, as well as in London and Europe, and studied a bit in America and so on. So I come, I hope, with some quite diverse perspectives. But the last 20 years of my life have been spent here on Uist in the Outer Hebrides, and that is where I have learnt most and got most of my insights around degrowth.
Thank you so much. Fantastic intro there for Fiona and Thomas. Yes, as I promised from the beginning of this episode talking, I said I'm going to have fantastic three questions for you, both of you. And yeah, as you can tell, I have no idea about degrowth and decolonization. I'm just learning as we go. So yes, the first question is, how would you explain or describe degrowth and decolonization to the people listening to this podcast?
Yeah. Thomas, I think if you start and then I'll come behind you.
Okay. So I want to go straight to the practice that we apply in our work. And so critical to us in terms of a degrowth approach is to start with what communities have, their assets, their strengths, rather than focusing on a deficit approach, which is what do they not have? And it's that deficit approach about what communities don't have that drives so much of the growth economy and all the destructive forces unleashed by that. And it is often the case that we live in an island community, which for most people in cities is very remote. And many rural areas in Scotland would also be regarded as city dwellers remote. We think that the city is remote from here, but that's be that as it may. And from their perspective, it's always that our remote areas, as they call them, need to catch up. And it's that constant driving of catching up to produce more and more economic growth that is so destructive. So what we start with is not what we don't have. We start with what we do have. And that applies across the board when we engage with our local communities. We also deliver enterprise workshops for new Scots refugees. And we take the same approach. Rather than focusing on, oh, it's really difficult for them to integrate because they don't have enough English and they're not sure about legal circumstances, they don't know about business. We start with, what experience and expertise, what passions, what insights do you bring? And it's really exciting to work with them because they come up with some amazing ideas. And as just one example, I know of three Syrian refugees who are all working on enterprises around recycling. furniture, building materials, and so on. And when I hear those people speak about what they're doing, I think they can lead other people in Scotland along these kind of new ways of working. So we focus on assets, on strengths, rather than what people don't have. And that's built in to a lot of coaching we do. Coaching is not where we're the expert and we talk with somebody and we direct them. So much advice is like that. What we want to do is create a safe and courageous space for those individuals or small groups to decide what they want to achieve and to allow them to explore that, to tap into their own understanding, their own wisdom, their own passions, and tap into their own expertise. So we follow the direction of where those people we're coaching want to go, where their passion is taking them, as they gradually unpack that and discover that for themselves. We don't direct them. And that is a key difference from a traditional colonial approach, where we are the experts. And as it happened, the people in developing countries where I have worked with many fantastic Indian development workers, there's still that approach that we're the experts and we need to tell them where they need to go. And it's a lot of rubbish. They know exactly where they want to go and they have huge expertise. And we need just to support that. Likewise, I'd look to them to support what we're trying to achieve. So it's a real mutual way of working together rather than setting us up in a hierarchy.
That's a good, amazing point there. I was just wondering, what are the challenges for you and the process working with these groups of refugees from different parts of the world and looking at the degrowth as well and decolonization, where they fit? I know you explained almost a bit of it, but I'm still wondering, what are the challenges on this process?
Let me talk about another framework which might help us understand degrowth. So let's take something like urban planning. Traditionally, when that first developed, there was a master planner, the expert, who would set up this grand plan for a city. We then moved to where we're focusing on projects, lots of projects with very distinct outcomes. And to some extent, that's where we are as a society, and particularly when it comes to rural areas and island communities, where there's a lot of focus on development, all the funding and resources allocated to that are using a project framework, and you decide on the outcomes you want to achieve in advance, and then you really work hard to achieve those outcomes, even if in the middle of the project you decide, actually, these are not the right outcomes. But you're committed to those outcomes. What we need to move away from that highly planned approach to a process approach, where processes are ongoing, they never stop, changes always happen, and you work with different groups and they interact sometimes closely, sometimes less closely. You don't know what the outcomes are. But that is that's a big challenge for us working in that kind of way, because all the resources and funding, particularly government funding, come with this insistence that a clear outcome predetermined is achieved. But if you predetermine it, you can't go through an open process because you've got to achieve that outcome. And you can't follow the process wherever it might lead. So I would say, Nico, that is the biggest challenge in using a degrowth approach in the work in islands and communities, islands and rural areas. Fiona, would you like to add something from the highland and island perspective?
Well, I think recognizing, building on the assets that you were outlining, Thomas, and the kind of philosophy of recognizing that which we have, I think Scotland and indeed many countries, as we're on the brink of, in fact, going through the process of climate change and having been through a pandemic, and in Britain's case, Brexit, you know, three very painful processes, you might say, and the biggest of all will be the climate emergency. And I see that the assets that we're looking for and the strengths are very apparent to us in the rural and peripheral areas, which are often referred to in the international sort of arena. From the OECD perspective, in a worldwide perspective, they talk about 80% of the land in the world is rural, with 30% of the population. In Scotland, it's 98% of the land is considered rural, with just 17% of the population. And yet the assets that are within that, if we are looking at, for example, food production, at the moment, so if we're talking about degrowth and we're talking about addressing the climate emergency, why are we bringing food that we can produce ourselves from the other side of the world? So we are able to, and in where I am in the Highlands and Islands, a lot of the land had, you know, a real colonial impact in terms of being run by a distant authority, so to speak, which meant that huge swathes of land were bought up and used as places of leisure, sporting estates. People would come and still come to shoot deer. And so you'll go through parts of the Highlands and Islands and you see a landscape that could be productive in a low intensive biodiverse kind of a way. And in terms of food production, which is completely stripped bare. You know, the tree line in the Highlands is 2,500 feet. There are no trees to be seen in many of the glens. And Highland area alone is the size of Belgium. It's a big area. And within that, just three people own more than 400,000 acres. So what happens on that land in terms of assets for Scotland as a whole is really important. If we think about renewable energy, Scotland is moving a lot towards having renewable energy, but who's owning that and who's benefiting it from it? There was a big contract awarded for a number of sites just last week for renewable energy. And of course, the promotion is talking about how marvelous this will be. This is a big company that was normally an oil-based company moving towards renewables. It's a good news story. But how is... are the Scottish people going to benefit? And in particular, the rural communities that host that renewable energy. Half a dozen jobs, maybe? It's not enough when these areas have suffering the highest levels of fuel poverty. So more building on these rural and island strengths, and that ties into not just what we know today in terms of low intensive agriculture, renewable energy, fresh water, coastal water, and these very natural assets. But actually, we don't have to look too far back, a couple of generations, where you had a very traditional way of working that was more circular economy, biodiverse, sustainable. And people really took seriously the custodianship of the land in which they were living and working, with always an eye to what their grandfathers and mothers had passed on to them, but what they were going to be handing on and leaving the land better that they found it. So following on from that, you've had a couple of generations where, quite frankly, to keep up with everybody else, they were kind of boxed into a corner to fall into global supply chains of productivity, moving from a mixed agricultural way of working to a monoculture, really intensive agriculture, really intensive production. To tie in with sort of supermarket chains and cheaper food for the urban centres. So yet again, everything structured for the value of the urban centre, far away from the areas that are actually producing, whether it's the food or the renewable energy. So, and I think even looking deeper into that would be within that custodianship and environmental awareness and that sense of place of recognizing what you have in your world around you comes into, and Nico, you and I were talking just before you started recording us, comes into the cultural recognition of that sense of who we are and our place in the world and how it works. And that ties into language, which you spoke about as well. And of course, I'm in a Gaelic speaking area here. And if you look back through there, cultural expression of songs and stories and dance and music and that community cohesion, you don't need me to tell you this, Nico, you know this, you were talking about it before, but that community cohesion that is interwoven with the cultural identity of who we are. You know, when you're in a time of crisis, and if you live, and you know this too, if you live in a place that is considered in GDP terms economically quite fragile, and many rural and peripheral areas are, why is it that people who are from those places feel their heart always belongs there? It's not because they're going to have loads of money. But, you know, even if they're on the other side of the world and they've gone to make their fortune, they'll tell you that their heart is back where they came from. Because it's that sense of who they are and where they are from, and actually is not defined by how much money is in their bank account. So I think, so, you know, in terms of practical things, I've spoken about food production and the fact that Scotland itself is so rural, but we're not the only ones. Iceland has exactly the same profile as Scotland, 80% of its population living in and around its capital city. So, but I mean, why are we not producing more of our food? So community ownership of land does go some way to address that, because at least it gives the communities themselves a power to work with the land to produce their own food or renewable energy for that matter.
Okay, great chat, great explanation there, both. I'm just going to move us straight to question number two. Question number two, how do you put these into practice in your work or in the community?
I think I really enjoy practice following these principles, because engaging with individuals and small groups and communities on a level where you've in a position of equality. You know, Fiona and I do much of our work locally within our own communities. And also we're helping our own communities to find out the real strengths that they have and to build on those. So we, for example, conducted a series of visioning workshops in partnership with the Social Enterprise Academy. And that was across rural Scotland, but we facilitated the two groups here on UIST to vision positive futures in the midst of a pandemic. And it was really powerful. One, it gave people a positive space to engage with each other, all online, of course, because it was in the midst of COVID-19. But it also gave a way of looking forward to say, we can still aspire to a positive future. Now, we were in the midst of the pandemic, and a lot of the ideas that emerged were very difficult to take forward at that time. But what I've been really pleased about is following this kind of process approach that I spoke about, is that just recently, so now in the very beginning of 2022, when we've seen through almost 2 years of pandemic conditions, that three people who created an idea almost, well, over a year ago in those visioning workshops are now looking to realize those ideas in practice. And I think that's really exciting. And again, because of the visioning workshops, we weren't driven by outcomes. We weren't saying to people, you've got to have a vision and now you've got to implement it. It's no, let's share our visions. And they really sparked off each other and they got really excited. And then you just let the process flow. And sure enough, three of those people just this month have come forward and saying, we are expected to deliver. So that is it's a very personal approach. It's very much people-centered approach. And it is very different from a traditional planning approach based on external expertise. And frankly, it's just a joy to work in that way. A real joy.
I love that, Thomas. Thomas, you said something very powerful. I want to use this phrase all the time.
let the process flow. That's really great. I like that. It's very nice. So yeah, same to you, Fiona. How do you put these ideas into practice and in your work and community? But just briefly, because I think Thomas already covered a bit.
Well, in many ways, we are shining a light on that which is already happening. So, for example, when people were talking about, you know, population decline, which is a real issue across the Highlands and Islands, actually, we were seeing a younger set of people coming back. When we say younger, we mean in their 20s and 30s and so on, coming back and doing amazing things. But actually, who was shouting about that? Who was telling the world about the positive impact they were having, the number of people that they were employing, or the number of people they were working with, the sort of resources they were working with, how they were developing their business? So whether it was a bakery, whether it's a distillery, there is a business here on Uist, which is using local wool and turning it into a premium value product that, when normally fleece from sheep is considered such, it's totally renewable, sustainable. It's a health welfare issue even for that fleece to be removed and make a really fantastic product, and yet is considered valueless in many of the markets, and yet makes a really good produce product. And so a lot of these businesses and enterprises and community ventures, whether it's leisure, whether it's food production, whether it's products and services, we have shone a light on those so that there is recognition, so much so that we do believe that the government now says, what about young people? Because they weren't saying that before, but they realize that they are the key to the future. And so encouraging them and to, for them to be inspired of what they can do in rural and island places in a more sustainable way, particularly, as I said before, in the context of climate change and COVID and Brexit, for that matter, and also in a positive way. Increased internet connectivity means that people can do whatever they want to do, wherever they want to do, increasingly. And that's really important. They don't have to go to the 10th floor of a block of flats in the city anymore. They can do it where they want to. And in a more mixed model kind of a way, so they can do that and they can possibly do something else that is perhaps more about, you know, being involved in community, growing food or something of that order, along with something that they're doing perhaps through the computer like we are today.
Oh, thank you.
Nico, I'd like to add just one thing that we also have spent a lot of time doing, which is simply recording voices of young people. And I think from a degrowth perspective, that's really important. These young people have returned, and a lot of people, even within our community, haven't noticed. And of course, they come with fresh perspectives, not least on the climate, on the economy, on society. And our role has been simply to record those voices and to share them more widely so that those young people who are often dispersed over vast areas have a collective voice that is heard. And from a, if you go back to colonial perspectives, that's really important, letting a group who are not being noticed, who have lots to contribute, just letting their voices be heard.
And it's important that those voices are not filtered. You know, rural and peripheral areas are researched a lot. You know, lots of central research areas come out and ask us loads of questions. We've had questions asked of us up one side and down the other. But actually, that's extractive, as we were talking about before. Whereas these voices, even when they are speaking in the recordings, you know, you can become an echo chamber where you're just all saying the same thing. But when you let the voices speak for themselves, actually, they'll come from different perspectives and through a different lens. And that's really important.
OK, now we are coming to the end of this episode. So I'm going to move on to question number 3. There is a phrase, if it's not just, it's not degrowth. What that means to you?
If it is not just, as in fair, it's not degrowth. Right. Okay. I can't argue with that. I think that's being just means fair for everybody. I mean, I too worked for a multinational corporation, and you know, that was rigged entirely for all the product that they delivered may be have a relatively good impact on people. We could debate that. But actually, in terms of how you move its manufacturing around the world to suit, you know, shareholders, where is the justice in that for the, you know, for the people in those countries if you close a factory? So that also comes back to the renewable energy. If you move those jobs for whatever reason, then where is the justice in that? So I think for it to be just, it must be rooted in communities, and it must be for community good and for community benefit, and not extractive and not international in that context. I think it's got to have real firm foundations in the place where it's at, where the people are.
And I will follow that on and re-emphasize how extractive the model, economic model, is that we in island and rural communities experience. And the most striking example at this very time is renewable energy, as the owner said. Good. So it's an extractive model where all the renewable energy, which is the vast, vast majority, is generated in the periphery, is targeted at urban areas. So we have this bizarre situation where we're generating most of the renewable energy that Scotland needs now and ever more so in the future. But we have in our areas the highest fuel poverty rates. That is simply not just. It's an extractive model, and we need to. And that extraction goes beyond, you know, it started off with sheep and deer and so on, so that the value of that land goes to the wealthy. It's now renewable energy. But the latest thing, it's also ideas. I think our community in the Outer Hebrides, which is still deeply rooted in this culture, is the closest in Britain that we're going to get to indigenous culture. And yet there is also this extractive model around knowledge itself, where external parties come and they extract this knowledge from us with these repeated surveys. And then they share that knowledge as though it's theirs. And they frame that knowledge, they process it, and they say, so that we no longer fully recognize what we apparently said. And then it's shared as their knowledge, as their insights, and they get the resources attached to that. That is deeply unjust, and it's deeply unjust, as we know, across Indigenous communities across the globe. So yes, justice has to be at the very heart of all the work we do.
Well, thank you so much, both. It was really nice talking to Fiona and Thomas on this episode. This podcast is exploring degrowth and decolonization in Scotland. Tune in over in the next few weeks to enjoy the discussions on this podcast. And I've got a special announcement here. On the 31st of March, 2022, we will be hosting a gathering in Glasgow. This gathering is open to anyone challenging our economic system in big or small ways. Check it out on enough.scot and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You'll find the Growth in Scotland podcast.